Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is the founder of TLA Systems, James Thompson. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. We always like to hear from developers who are doing cool and exciting stuff. And I think your calculator has been so cool for a long time. And I was an early customer of DragThing. I remember using it quite a while ago. I don't know if you remember me from the customer roles, but
it was one of my favorite apps
for a long time.
I remember everyone.
So before we get into life as an Apple developer, I wanted to ask you about your early career, inspirations, what got you into computers, as we do on Background Mode. So I want to chat with you about that, because it's always interesting to hear about how people get turned on and excited and start launching their careers and then finally end up, you know, doing what they're doing now.
Well, I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and the personal computer was on the rise in the UK particularly. And I think it was possibly my initial inspiration was films like Tron, where, you know, the computer was painted as this, you know, exciting thing. And around about 83 or so, I got my first computer, which was a Commodore 64. And I picked that purely on the basis that it had a slightly better version of Pac-Man on it. But that was really where I got started. And one of the things that happened around about that time was our school, and this was primary school, so I was about, you know, sort of 11 or 12 or something at the time. And we got I think it was one of the first personal computers in Scotland for schools, and it was a BBC Model B computer.
I've never heard of that.
Well, it was some co-production with the BBC and Acorn, I think, and it was notable for having a very good version of BASIC on it, and it was used a lot in sort of in the UK for educational stuff.
So that was a home-brewed version of BASIC.
Well, no, I mean it was a full proper computer. I mean, I can't remember the exact details of it, but there was a number of predecessors to it, which were, you know, you build yourself type things. But this was a full, you know, it was similar to a Commodore 64, I guess. And it was one of the things that they did was they came around the school and they said, we've just got this thing called a computer and we don't know what it is. Do any of you, you know, in the classes have computers? And we said, you know, I think there was four of us put our hands up. And so we became the guardians of the personal computer in the school. And we ended up doing classes for the younger kids.
You said this was at age 12?
Yeah. I'm trying to think exactly. So it would be seven. Yeah, it would be about 12. So we had the younger kids would come in, you know, just before school started, and we would go through all the educational software with them. And we'd also be teaching the teachers how to use the computer.
So instead of being guardians of the galaxy, you were the guardians of the computers.
Yeah. And we ended up, I mean, this is like 12-year-olds. We had our own office. Four of us in this computer room, and we spent pretty much most of that final year of primary school messing around with the computer and becoming, in quotes, experts.
Awesome.
And yeah, so that's where I started. And, you know, I had a Commodore 64, and I did some very basic programming on it. And, you know, I just wanted to sort of like make little spaceships fly around the screen, that sort of stuff. And then I upgraded from Commodore 64 to a Commodore 128, then to an Atari STE, which I mainly got for the music stuff because it had MIDI ports on the side, and I fancied myself a musician at the time. And then first year of university in 1990, we I got to use a Mac for the first time. And
I noticed you glossed over the Apple II. The Apple II didn't penetrate very well into the UK in its early years.
No, it didn't.
I was talking to somebody else about that.
I did have experience of it because my next door neighbor, who was a professor at the university here, he was American and he had an Apple II. So I'd played with that. I mean, I played around with it, you know, very kind of early stuff. But
what did you think of it compared to the Atari?
Well, I mean, the Atari at the time, I mean, it had a GUI, so it was more sophisticated. I mean, it was later on, but you know, I didn't really use the Apple II for anything more than playing games. But the thing was when I first used the Mac, I realized that the Mac was, you know, or rather the Atari was just a poor copy of the Mac, and that this was the original, and there was just something about it that was so well designed. And I mean, one of my favorite classes at university was in user interface design. So we had a year long class on that. And they basically took apart lots of pieces of the Mac, you know, so we would spend an entire lesson on the open and save dialogues, you know, why are they designed the way they're designed, and, you know, looking at all the sort of little minute details and that kind of thing. And that was really the best classes that I had at university, and that's kind of where I've ended up now.
Were you aware of the technical limitations of the early Mac, you know, the simplicity of the file system and the fact that it wasn't preemptive multitasking and things like that?
No, and I mean, at the time, it was, I mean, this was, as I say, 90. It was, you know, way ahead of most things that were there. And I had used some, you know, Sun workstations and stuff like that as part of my university as well. But, you know, there was no prospect of me owning some, you know, $10,000 Spark Station thing. So, you know, the Mac itself was expensive enough. Luckily, there was a very good educational discount available on Macs. So that's where I bought my first Mac, was a Mac Classic 440, I think. That was around 92, maybe 91, something like that. And that was really where I started and started programming the Mac.
As I recall, the mentality was sort of like, okay, these Unix Sun workstations, these are things that are very expensive. They're very high end. We're not quite sure why they're so expensive and how they work, but we love our Macs because it's so simple and easy to use. And there wasn't a whole lot of perspective about its limitations. There was just joy at how it functioned.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you can look back at these things now and say, oh, it was really bad that when one thing crashed, it took out the whole machine. But,
right,
you know, you just wrote your software so that it didn't do that.
So after that, tell me about your early career, early job. You tell me.
Okay, so, I mean, where I started was pCalc actually started in 92 while I was at university. And the first version was released in December 1992. And that was written in Pascal. And I had written that, and I wrote Drag Thing, the first version of that, a few years later in 94. And I was looking for a job in Mac programming. And I was very nearly ended up working for Tetra Pak, who make the like milk cartons and stuff in the UK, because they, for some crazy reason at the time, were running their entire factory production floor using Macs, which is fairly unusual to say the least. And so they had a big desire for Mac programmers. So I had applied to them along with a friend of mine, and he was about a week ahead of me in the interviews. And he got back for a second interview and was offered a job. I was coming up for my second interview, and then they discovered that they had no money and they couldn't actually afford to hire anybody. So I didn't get that job. But I was talking about this to the head of the systems team at the university and for my computing science department. And he was like, well, you could always just work here. So that's what I did. And I spent 2 years working, basically doing, being a system admin and looking after the Mac labs in the computing science department in Glasgow. And it was, I wrote software, you know, small bits of software to aid the labs and things. And that's really where I got started.
Honing your skills.
Yeah. And I think it was 2 years into that that I had been releasing pCalc and DragThing for a while. And they always had little things in the README saying that I wanted to work for Apple. And somebody emailed me from Apple in Cork and said, that's in Ireland, and said, would you like to come and work for us? We have a small development team here. So I went over, interviewed, and got the job. And that's when I started working for Apple. And
that was in
1996. So I joined just at the point that Apple was, you know, about to crash into the ground.
That was a bad year for Apple.
I worked on the Copeland project, the failed Mac OS 8.
Oh, cool. I got to ask you about that. Oh,
well, I worked on it for the grand total of about a week. So.
Well, the reason I wanted to ask you was because I've interviewed some other people who have talked about Copeland as this some sort of mythical thing from a distance where, you know, Apple talked about it and you read about it in Mac Week and you thought it was real. And then I've had some people tell me, well, no, it really didn't really exist. And it wasn't on a sound roadmap. And it ended up just being kind of wrapped into Mac OS 8.
Well, I mean, I think there was a lot of interesting stuff in it. And I think I was working on the installer for a week. So, you know, they clearly had things that they needed to install with it. Mm-hmm. But it got, when it was cancelled, people internally, I think, didn't really believe that this was going to happen. And people just kept working on it, even after the internal cancellation.
Wow. I mean, well, as I recall, Copeland broke classic apps, right? And there was this big fuss about trying to get developers to move on to a new operating system that broke their apps. And they went, no, we don't think so. Wasn't that right?
Well, I mean, I think it was an evolution of the API. So you need to rebuild your apps. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't think it was a complete... I mean, Apple's done worse these days, going between OS releases. But I didn't have that much access to it, you know, and I was like very new into the world. But I was just aware of all the sort of political stuff that was going on, and the fact that Apple was posting all these losses, and then, you know, my manager resigned just after I joined. And
how long did that job last?
I was at Apple for 4 years, so I did see, like, well, we'll get onto it, but I, you know, I saw things start to take off.
Oh, so you survived. It was, like, what, 92 to 96?
No, 96 to
2000, sorry.
Yeah. So I was working on a bunch of stuff for Apple Cork, small stuff, but later on I worked on my first sort of Mac OS X piece. Was it was an authentication server for, I don't know if you remember AtEase, which was like the sort of simplified login environment that you could use for education and stuff.
Oh, kind of. Yeah, it rings a bell.
And it had a very simplified finder.
Did you have to put DragThing on hiatus because you were working for Apple?
No, at this point, it was interesting. When I joined, I basically got an agreement that anything that I had done previously, I could keep going on and just work on my own time, obviously.
Nice.
But I don't think you get that kind of deal these days going into Apple, especially into Apple in the States.
Yeah.
But it was a very different time and things were a lot looser. But yeah, so I was working on this authentication thing, and it turned out we were actually part of the iMac project, and we didn't actually realize this until we were in the Flint Center and Steve Jobs introduced the iMac, and we all kind of looked at each other and was like, are we working on this project? And it's like, and he said, and it's going to ship in 90 days, and we were like, nah. But the thing that I'm sort of most known for working in Apple was I worked on the Mac OS X Finder and the dock. So I was basically working on and replacing, killing off DragThing by writing the dock, which was an interesting thing to do because, of course, I couldn't tell anybody at all.
But nobody was better positioned than you.
Well, that was the theory, indeed. What happened with all that was interesting. Steve Jobs discovered, after I'd been working on stuff for about a year or so, Steve Jobs discovered that I was working on the doc from Ireland. And at this point, everything was completely secret. And he got quite upset about that. And since this podcast does not have an explicit tag, I will not be able to say what
please
he said. He basically said, it has come to my attention that the engineer working on the dock is in bleep Ireland. And I was told that I had to move over to Cupertino or else, and I didn't really want to move to Cupertino. So I thought that was going to be it. And they said, well, tell you what, we'll just tell Steve that you've moved over. And so
that's a pretty bold move for somebody to pull on Steve.
and I had a corridor in the Finder team in Cupertino, even though I was working from Cork, and I would fly over there, you know, lots of times a year, just, you know, if there was going to be a demo of the dock or anything to Steve.
How did you do that? Was there a nonstop, or did you have to lay over in New York or something?
You had to go, I think it was Cork, Dublin, Dublin, San Francisco was the usual flight, or it might have been Cork, London, London, San Francisco.
London, San Francisco.
I think it was actually London.
13-hour flight or something.
It's about 10 for the long bit, but yeah, it's an all-day thing. But no, it definitely was London, because I was flying Virgin Atlantic for a lot of the flights. And, you know, this went on for another year of working on stuff. And then everything was finally shown at Macworld in 2000. And I thought that would be it. Everything would be, you know, out in the open, so there wouldn't be any more stress. But I was given another ultimatum to move over or else. And I chose the else this time. And I was told that, you know, there would be no guarantee of any interesting work ever again. I resigned, and sometime after that they fired the entire remaining Cork development team because they were trying to pull everything back into Cupertino, but of course they hadn't told me that that was what was going to happen. And I left. Somebody else took over the dock after me, and the first thing they did was throw away 18 months worth of work. And so the dock that shipped in 1.0 or 10.0 was not my work, and that was the end of my Apple career.
Let me ask you a dicey question here. Do you think their doc was better or worse than yours?
Well, I will be political and I'll say
no, tell us what you think. It's okay.
There were certain things that I wanted to do with the dock that didn't happen. And the thing was, the design came from Apple's HI group. So, you know, it wasn't, I was trying to color within the lines and make it the way I wanted to work, but, you know, it didn't go there. And it was interesting. I mean, my dock shipped in the developer preview 3, I think it was. And John Siracusa did a review of that, the DP3 thing, and he singled out the dock and he said basically it was a failure on every level. And so that was.
Maybe it was good you were off the hook.
Yeah, possibly. But it was a very interesting time and experience, and I was at Apple at a very pivotal point where, you know, Steve Jobs came back and. Yeah. Everything changed. So I got to see some really exciting stuff, and I made a lot of friends there who, you know, are still friends today.
So speaking of pivotal points, I think this is a good time for us to take our customary break. Folks, we're going to do a short commercial here, but we'll be right back in 60 seconds. So stay with us. And when we're done, I want to talk to James about being an Apple developer these days. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO, or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. Well, we're back. James, I want to ask you now, how did pCalc emerge in this era then? Because this is one of my favorite apps of all time, and I'd like to know more about how it emerged and fill us in now. So the days at Apple were over.
So yeah, one of the things I've always used pCalc for is as a small bit of code that I can port to any new platform to get a feel for the platform and learn it. So when I was first learning the Mac, that's, you know, back in 92, that's what I used. I wrote a small app, you know, calculators, a fairly manageable thing, wrote that to learn the Mac OS. And then after I'd left Apple, you know, I'd been working on Mac OS 10, but I wanted to get my code running on it. So I took pCalc and I rewrote it from scratch, basically.
Was this the birth of TLA Systems?
Well, TLA Systems is actually came about in 97 while I was still at Apple, because
Of the drag thing, right?
Once a drag thing started selling, I needed like an actual company. So, you know, the company was founded as a way to, a tax efficient way to deal with the profits. that kept going in the background, and my wife was actually working at Apple at the time as well, and she left Apple to run the business side of the company while I was still working away on the dock and stuff. So after I moved back to Glasgow, and I was wanting, you know, a small project to work on Mac OS X, so I ported pCalc to it. And then once I had pCalc running and I'd learned enough, I then ported DragThing over, which was a much bigger bit of code. And again, when the iPhone appeared, pCalc was the perfect bit of code to port over.
Absolutely. I got to tell you, there were so many calculator apps that came out for the iPhone, and so many of them were amateurish and bad. And I remember writing a review of one of those apps, and I was going, you know, you wouldn't want to design a Boeing 787 wing with one of these calculators.
Well, I mean, pCalc had been around for a long time. So, you know, I'd had at that point, what are we talking, 14 years it had been around or something. And so, yeah, I mean, it had been through the wars a bit. My idea was that I would port pCalc over, and then I would have learned about iOS, and then I would write the iOS app that I was going to write, you know, the real big idea. The problem was that, you know, pCalc was one of the first apps on the store of the first 400. Mm-hmm. It got a shout out in the keynote at WWDC. It was one of the icons on the screen.
I remember that.
And yeah, it was, the problem was it then started selling, and it started selling more than I was making out of DragThing or anything else.
Even at the hefty price you introduced it at, right?
Well, I mean, you say hefty, it was...
Well, yeah, I want to talk about that, so go ahead.
So pCalc on the Mac was $20, and that was the price it had always been. And when the app stores were coming out, there was a lot of discussion on what, you know, the pricing was going to be, mm-hmm. because... it was kind of like a blind auction. Everybody was thinking about how they were going to set their prices, and you could see some people were thinking, well, if I undercut this other person. And
right.
So
and $1.99 kind of became the low bar.
Yeah, but I think when we started, it wasn't quite so clear. But I set it to $10, and to me, this was me halving the price. But it was fair, because at that point the iOS version didn't do everything the Mac version did. But so I made it $10, and it was selling, and it was selling well. So I kept it at $10. And, you know, people were cutting their prices down to 99 cents. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, mm-hmm. I'm still selling at $10. You know, I would need to sell more than 10 times as many copies in order to make as much revenue. So I'm going to keep it at $10. And I've stuck to that for the whatever 9-10 years that the store's been there. And it still seems to be working.
I have a long history with Hewlett-Packard calculators going way back. And I remember looking at pCalc on the iPhone and going, this is worth $10. This is a very good app. It's worth even more than $10.
Well, I mean, those physical calculators were, you know, hundreds of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
and I loved that you did RPN.
Well, one of the things is I'm not an RPN user myself, but I know so many people that are, and they were all like, you need to add RPN to pCalc. So
I'm so glad you did that.
So I did, and I think that's one of the reasons that it's popular amongst people who don't mind spending $10 on an app.
Because mm-hmm. They kind of grew up with their Hewlett-Packard calculator, and they see pCalc with RPN, reverse polished notation, for you guys out there who don't know about that. And this is a great way of ensuring your data entry, where you see intermediate results and you have a stack. And it's just such a beautiful, logical way to do computations. Anyway, return from subroutine.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of pricing, I'm going to stick with $10 as, you know, as long as the app goes, I think.
Is it still selling well?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's our main income. It's like 90% of our income at this
point.
How
are people discovering it, may I ask? How do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I think a lot of it is, well, pCalc has been around for, you know, 24 years or something. So is that right? I need to, ironically, I need to do the math to work that out. But yeah, 24 years. And it was bundled on the Anglepoise white IMAX in the US, which is another story in itself. So that was, you know, a sizable number of people that had that on the machine that they bought. So I think also I'm somewhat of a known figure. You know, there's been a number of controversies with pCalc, like with the widgets and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, I'm visible, and I think that's how people are discovering it. But I think the main reason that people know it is, you know, if I have happy customers, they tell other happy people, you know, and
yeah.
That sort of organic way of spreading it seems to be the main thing. I mean, so we've got the two things. We have the new subscription model that people are talking about, and I'm not certain that that is something that pCalc is suitable for.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, a calculator is something that we tend to think of as enduring, as a utility. And the last thing you want to have happen is be sitting there in an exam with your calculator and having it come up and say, oh, your subscription's expired.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, from a developer point of view, from a business point of view, it would be nice to have some kind of recurring income because, you know, we don't have any mm-hmm. really good way to say, you know, we want to charge for an upgrade. So if I work away and I do some big update to pCalc, you know, all I can do is I can either create a new product, you know, and then you'll end up with two things on the store and it just becomes confusing. And also you lose all the search placement and the reviews and the goodwill basically from
right.
the previous version. So I can't, you know, I can't say, oh, I've got this new version, you know, could you give us an extra $5 for it or something?
Right. Is there a way in a subscription process that you know of to kind of alert the user and say your subscription expires in 30 days?
I haven't looked into the technical details of that. And I think there are things that you could do, like if a subscription lapsed, you know, you could fall back onto basic functionality, that sort of thing.
Interesting.
But to be honest, I mean, as a developer, I like the idea of recurring income, but I don't think users are particularly keen on subscriptions. They like to sort of buy something and feel that they own it.
there might be certain kinds of apps that are amenable to subscriptions where the app is growing and every year, you know, we basically buy our iPhones on subscriptions. You know, we buy a new phone every year and pay that. But yeah, you're right. I think a calculator is such a fundamental utility that one has to really think long and hard about whether it should be a subscription app, unless it's just a financial necessity. And it sounds like it's not for you. So
currently, yeah, I mean, currently we're doing well, and I don't want to sort of ruin that. And I think, you know, if I keep updating PCALC and keep making people happy, which has been my sort of marketing strategy.
Mm-hmm. You're doing a good job.
So happy users tell other people, they keep buying it. You know, if you start messing with that and you like saying, oh, you now have to pay me, you know, $10 a month, mm-hmm. or not a month, that's it. But, you know, a dollar a month or something like that. People are just going to be turned off by that, I think.
I think you're right. We only have a few minutes left, so I wanted to jump forward a little bit. And I know you went to WWDC. So we had to push the podcast back a little bit until you got back. So what did you think? Tell me your thoughts about what you saw and directions of iOS and...
I was very pleased. I haven't been out for WWDC in 3 years. So I like to go out every 2 to 3 years, just keep up contacts and talk to people and meet people. So, you know, from that perspective, it was a great conference because I got to talk to a lot of people, a lot of Apple engineers, just friends and people that I don't see very often out there. And to a certain extent, that is the benefit of going to WWDC, because these days you can get the sessions live streamed. Sure. Now. So, you know, actually being in the room for a session is not as exciting as it once was. I mean, the most exciting part is you can go up afterwards and you can talk to the people who just gave the session. But no, I was very happy. I mean, there was big changes. The biggest thing that stuck out initially was watchOS 3. Because of the changes they made, might actually make the watch apps useful. Because currently, you know, it's like tap on a watch app and wait 5 to 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And then 50-50 chance whether it launches at all. And that just makes the apps... I mean, I like the PCALC version that I've done on the watch, and I've heard from people that really like it and use it. But being able to make it much more accessible and launch instantly, I think will be... hugely useful for the watch.
Are you seeing anything in iOS 10 that makes you think, oh, here's an opportunity to expand the capabilities of PCALC or not?
Well, when I was at the conference, the standard joke that people were saying to me as I was walking around was, so you're going to do PCALC for the Messages app? And I was thinking, well... I know, you know, people say, well, you know, they showed the thing of, you know, you're ordering your 5,000 curries in the keynote. And it's like, surely, you know, some kind of tip calculator that you could, you know, go back and forward between people and work something out. And I was like, yeah, maybe there's an idea there. I don't know. That is verging on the, I'm not sure if it's a silly idea or if it's actually a genius idea, but I might play with that. At the moment, they changed the widget stuff quite a bit, so I'm playing around with the widgets, trying to make them fit in with the new style of doing things. And there's a lot of interesting stuff. There's some stuff which is going to be a bit painful to deal with. There's now a requirement that all apps use HTTPS.
Right.
And one of the things I do, I talk to an old server that's not under my control that doesn't use HTTPS. And I've heard from a lot of other people who have, you know, talking to legacy stuff, and this is just completely breaking them. So, you know, there's little things like that. But, there's, you know, for me, there's probably a way around that. But on the whole, you know, there's... opening up lots of the system apps, you know, like Messages being a good example, that's a very positive thing, you know, Apple letting third-party developers into that sort of level of integration. So I think there'll be a lot of interesting stuff come out of it.
Do you feel under any stress in that another year rolls around and, oh my God, thousands of new APIs and Apple initiatives and requirements and changes to the developer program? Is it hard to keep up with all that?
It's your job to a certain extent. I mean, this year, well, in the past year, we had watchOS and tvOS, both of which I did versions of pCalc for. But you know, this year doesn't actually seem too bad. There's nothing fundamental that we need to completely rip out of our apps and rewrite. So I think this year will be not too bad in terms of stress levels. It's always stressful. I mean, especially when it comes up to the time, like around when iOS comes out and then the new macOS comes out. And there's usually new devices and last minute new APIs. Mm-hmm. Like we had the 3D touch stuff last year, which was basically, you know, you have a week in order to implement something before the devices come out. But you know, we'll see. It's my job.
And you're doing a very good job.
Well, thank you.
Well, I think we're about out of time. This has been a great discussion. It's always great to hear the insights of a developer, especially you, and especially the developer of a most beloved and awesome app.
Well, thank you. So, time has flown past. We're at like nearly 38 minutes already.
One more question.
Okay.
Are you prepared? I don't want to put you under the gun here, but any thoughts about future development and directions? Prying, of course.
Well, it's a difficult question because I spend, you know, pretty much all of my time on pCalc right now because, as we said, you know, Apple brings out all these new platforms and new features and things.
So this is good. This is a good thing. Money keeps rolling in.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the hopeful theory of it. Yeah, I mean, I think about returning to DragThing because DragThing really needs a rewrite, but I don't know if the market is there for it these days. And that's, you know, you're talking about 6 months to a year to spend on something to actually rewrite it from scratch. So, you know, that was something that I'd considered doing at the first half of this year, and I just didn't get around to because of a whole bunch of stuff that happened.
I think people are pretty settled on the dock.
Yeah, I mean, that you would be surprised that there are a lot of very hardcore users of DragThing out there. I just did an update about a month ago to fix a bug that had been around for a while. And that was because John Syracuse emailed me and said, look, you need to fix this bug. And I was like, I can't even build the app currently. So I had to actually set up a special development environment that could build the old source code and get it out and get it working again. And I fixed a whole bunch of other stuff along the way. But yeah, there are people out there like John who are very set on DragThing. So, you know, I'm going to keep it running as long as I can, but I would like to get it to a point where it's a more modern code base. But yeah, it's still 6 months to a year of work and no actual guarantee that there would be income for that work. So,
well, whatever you decide to do, I know it'll be great. Okay, so let's wrap it up. It's been a fascinating and wonderful discussion. Thanks for being on the show, James.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
The best way is via Twitter. I'm James Thompson. That's Thomson. Otherwise, go to pcalc.com, pcalc.com, for pCalc. And I've now, one of the new domains that we have is we have tla.systems as a domain. So that's the sort of overall company one.
Cool. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. James, it was great. Thanks for coming by, and all you out there, we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.